from Vision Australia Radio, it's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Inno, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine. We're on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And it's hello from our producer, Lloyd Shirley. Today it's my pleasure to introduce seventh-generation winemaker from Victoria's northeast, Simon Killeen, who is busy pursuing his passion for Portuguese grape varieties and recently struck out on his own with his own label, Samau and Co. Wines, of course, where he not only wants to craft sublime vintage port, much like his famous father Chris did at Stanton and Killeen, but also make savoury table wines of distinction from Portuguese varietals. Olá, Simon. And welcome to Grapevine.
Thank you, Michael.
Como estás?
Tudo bem.
Good. That's a little bit of my rustic Portuguese. It took me hours to really try and get the pronunciation right, but that's how are you. Now, I believe you're occasionally mistaken for rugby league legend Billy Slater. Maybe one day Billy may be mistaken for you. Look, first of all, you're a Rutherglen boy through and through, and your late father, Chris, helped revolutionise vintage port production in Australia, transforming the traditional unctuous sweet style into something much drier, more fragrant and complex, and ultimately, some say, profound. Chris liked the drier Portuguese style made from different grape varieties, often five or six of them, with names beginning with a T, and I can't get my pronunciation around these. It's Tintacao?
Correct.
Tinta-R-O-R-I-Z?
That's Roriz, but in Portuguese it's Horish.
Horish, thank you. Tinta Barroca, have I got that one right?
Correct.
Oh, just think of the old Barroca there, got that one. And of course, Tariga. Simon, this explains your love of port, but generation winemaking doesn't always go smoothly, and losing both your father and grandfather within 3 years of one another when you were just 20 was part of the reason you ultimately decided to strike out on your own and leave Stanton Killeen and led to the creation of Samau & Co. Tell us the story of it. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I was working at Stanton Killeen for about 3 years, and I'd previously worked around the world and Australia for about 7 years. And I'd got to the point that I just thought, I want a bit more freedom. I want a bit more creativity, and I'd like to make some wines that I probably wouldn't have got the chance to make in Rutherglen.
Yeah.
So my backyard essentially is the northeast of Victoria.
So that's where you source fruit from, is it?
Yes.
Yes. And where do you actually make the wine?
Any bit of real estate that I can find.
Right,
I beg,
right.
Borrow, and steal. I was making wine with a group of garagistes, we'll call us, in Beechworth in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So my clique of friends, those three of us, we bunked in together and had a lot of fun and helped each other out. And then this year I relocated back to Rutherglen because it was just logistically easier to be close to home. And I was making wine with a friend, Anton Thekildsen, at Valhalla Wines
in Wagunya. Oh, yes, yes, in Wagunya. Right. Now, your mother, Wendy, is busy pursuing Iberian varieties, including white wines like Alvarinho and Arinto. Is it A-R-I-N-T-O?
Arinto.
Arinto, back at Stanton Killeen. And your sister, Natasha, is finishing her Master of Wine business in Canberra. However, like you, she's in no rush to return to Stanton Killeen, I believe. I think she'll strike out on her own somewhere else, maybe.
Perhaps.
Yes, I'm saying. Tell me, what's the essence of what you're aiming to achieve with your new venture, and why Portugal?
Why not?
Why not?
I love the Portuguese varieties. I think they are so suited to the climate of Rutherglen, because if you look at a lot of the Portuguese regions, they're quite dry, and they've got a lot of sunshine hours, and those varieties that are in the Douro Valley, so the Tariga and the Tintas that you were talking about, they have a beautiful tannin structure and flavour profile, which performs well in, I won't say drought, but drier summers.
Yep.
The whites as well, they have beautiful fragrance, but they maintain their acidity, which I think is the key thing for warmer climates. At the moment, we're seeing fantastic results with Vermentino and Fiano because of the same reason.
Yes.
In regions like Riverland and Riverina.
Yes. Very underrated wines, aren't they?
Exactly. I totally agree. But people haven't quite jumped on the Tarigas yet, but I think they are gaining a lot of popularity. I'm seeing a lot of them coming out of Langhorne Creek, McLaren Vale.
Yep.
And other places, but Rutherglen, I think it's probably it's a more suited climate.
But see, those grapes have been up there for quite a while, planted, haven't they?
Correct.
Yeah, they've been there since De Castella's time, just about.
Very
they?
Correct. I actually was doing some research recently and looking in some old newspapers, and there was a fantastic article in a newspaper in 1923 that he brought out wines from Portugal with all these different varieties.
This is François.
François de Castella, when he was located
at the research station.
The Rutherglen Viticultural College.
Yep.
And he showed the local vignerons all these wines and said, this is from the varieties. And there was a couple of vineyards who embraced those. They had the cuttings in the nursery and they planted them to quite a large extent. So they've been around Rutherglen for quite some time.
But they've gone into fortified wines, not necessarily dry table wines, haven't
Correct.
They? So, and the challenge for Rutherglen is to reinvent itself without abandoning the fortified tradition, because there are generations that really haven't tasted fortified.
The last, I say about the, there's probably two generations of drinkers in Australia who are not au fait with the concept of fortified wines. Recently I was at a tasting that the drinkers before that didn't understand what the concept of a vintage port was. They understood port as a sweet elixir, I guess.
Yep.
They didn't understand there was a tawny port, a ruby port style, or a vintage port style, or even a white port style.
White port, yes.
So I had to educate them again. But that's fun for me. I like that.
But that's good, and that's a sort of Don Quixote dream. But in the meantime, you've got to stay alive and to generate enough income to make these wines while they gain acceptance. And things are slow on change, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
People are slow to change, and no matter how, it's an innately still conservative market. So how do you survive in the meantime, and who do you bring along with you to share the dream? Because you're a bit like Andrew Sutherland Smith at Warrabilla, in a sense. He's declared that, look, I'm going to make my wines a certain way. They've got a good deal of alcohol in them. And then people go, ooh, alcohol, and they get all in a tiz about that. His wines are all about mouthfeel, and you either like them or you don't. And his customers love them. So, I mean, who cares what the media says? So, in the sense, you're doing your own thing and you've planted a foot in the ground. But you've got to survive in the meantime. It's not easy. And who else do you think will come along with you who will catch the bug? Is there anyone else in, apart from Wendy, who's apparently going to go in the same direction? Somewhat ironically, perhaps?
Ironically? No, perhaps because I was the one who instigated all those plantings.
You were the one, behind it.
I've long wanted to do it.
Yeah.
When you say come along for the ride, do you mean those alternative varieties? Do you mean those styles of wines?
Other winemakers will embrace what you're doing too. Because if you're onto a good thing and you're trailblazing, other people might start to pick up and say, well, Simon's onto something. We'll replicate what he's doing.
They say the greatest form of flattery is replication. We'll wait and see. I was making the Prince blend at S&K in 2008 and a couple of years subsequently after that as well. And they are fascinating varieties to play with. And there's a lot of people in South Australia tinkering, a couple in Western Australia as well.
Mm.
So there already is interest.
Wayne Farquhar at Deleuze has got a lot of interesting clonal selection of Italian varieties.
Mm.
And I think he's got a few Portuguese.
Okay.
And there is a winery in WA somewhere that has it.
I'm trying to remember the name of it, but you are correct. They've got about six different varieties.
Yeah, I'll come back to that sometime, because I'm sure I've got it written down somewhere. But now you've brought along some very interesting wines today, including your 2014 Shiraz and Tempranillo, along with a freshly bottled Sauve Blanc, and I call it Trebbiano, but you call it something else, don't you?
The Uni Blanc.
Uni Blanc, yes. I just like Trebbiano, the way it rolls off
the Italian name for it.
Yep. And, of course, your 2014 Vintage Port. Now, my guess is is that either the wine of the week will be your Tempranillo or your vintage port. Which one would you like to select and why?
I can't go past my favourite. I love my vintage port.
Right. Well, look, take us through. This week's wine of the week, I'll hand over to Simon, is...
the 2014 vintage port.
From Simao.
Simao & Co, correct.
And Co. Take us through the flavour profile. What's it all about?
It is a beautifully perfumed wine. I was lucky to get some very nice spirit, which is a difficult thing in Australia at the moment.
Yep.
But all about beautiful violets, crushed raspberries, crushed blackberries, and that nice almond kernel that you get the spirit, the benzaldehyde character.
Yes.
But masses of slurpy fruit. And then the palate, although quite elegant in comparison, which is the style I go for, it does have a lot of depth and flavour. It's got a really nice, beautiful, dry tannin structure, but also the dryness comes from the alcohol as well. Really, and it's still integrating at the moment because it's so young. However, it is, I won't call it complete because, as I said, it is integrating, but it is quite attractive and flavoursome and does taper off into a very nice long finish.
And the alcohol content, of course, being a port?
20.
20, so it's, you're nudging it up a bit. So for a little longer life. Am I going to live long enough to be able to drink this? When's it drinking, do you think it'll drink at its optimum?
To be honest, today is a very good opportunity.
Today's always good.
I love drinking young vintage port because I like seeing what those wines are when they are young.
Here's to vintage port. We'll clink out glasses. Oh, actually, I'll just take a sip, excuse me. Oh, absolutely delicious. You don't know what you're missing, folks. So that's so how much have you made of this? Small quantities?
Most of my wines are small quantities. Yeah. I've made about 150 cases of my vintage port, in the scheme of things is probably biting off a lot more than I can chew, considering it's a fortified wine. But I set out to make a great vintage port, and that's what I do. I want to make fantastic, beautiful, long-lived wines, in particular the vintage port.
Yep.
So would you like me to talk about how I made it?
Yes. Before you do, where do you think you're going to sell it? Are you going to concentrate in restaurants or retail or just through a list, develop your own?
A bit of everything, Michael. I've got a few friends who are sommeliers and I've spoken to them a lot over the years doing masterclasses with
Port. Not the one at the... a guy at the RACV, I think, is...
I'm actually about to... briefly talking to him because he's Portuguese and he's asking a few questions. So, just firing back a few emails.
What's his name? I can't remember now.
Francisco?
Yes. That's it. Yes.
But I've been trying to talk to people about vintage port as an accompaniment to main meals.
And even
desserts. But getting the wine served on degustations to actually get people to understand and...
Good idea.
...to see them.
Welcome back. Simon, you're talking about, you're going to tell us about how you go about making this port, but I'm fascinated by your, or interested in saying, it's a very good way to get the port exposed and people to try it. Is it a tasting or degustation menu, of which there are a growing number in restaurants now? And it has a much wider application than people think. Port and cigars at the end of the meal and all that, woofer. That's really in the past now. And that's what you're really saying, isn't it?
Totally. I totally agree.
Now, how do you go about making this? Because it wouldn't be an easy task, would it?
Not at all. The 14 vintage was one of difficulty in northeast Victoria. There was a horrendous black frost that came about in October 2013, November or so, and decimated the area. I remember I was driving around the area and saw vineyards that just turned brown and black within a matter of a couple of days. And the frost was that intense, they stayed like that for quite a while. So I had to source fruit outside the region. So I put my ear to the ground and I was quite particular about what varieties I wanted, and I was lucky enough to source the Portuguese variety. So Tinta Cow, Barroca, Tarega Nacional, Tinta Horish, Alicante Biche, and I also topped it up with a bit of Shiraz and Jerif as well, because I love those varieties just to give a bit of substance and backbone amongst all those elegant characters you get from the Portugueses. When I was a winemaker in Portugal in 2012, I was a winemaker for Quinta Croft or Quinta de Roeda. I picked up a lot of things that I had only ever read about, and then I finally got to do them in practice, and I thought, that's exactly what I want to do. That's how I want to make my ports, which we weren't doing at home in S&K. So in 2014, the fruit all came in, and it was crushed to vat.
Yes.
Stalks included, 100%. And I got a list of my friends who were willing to help and be paid in good food and good wine. And we all jumped in and we sloshed around and we did full foot stomp for about 2 days.
Yep.
In particular, first day, we did it for about 4 hours on 4 hours straight.
Yep.
And then I let the ferment start naturally.
Yes.
Just let it do its thing.
Yep.
And extracted all this beautiful colour and these lovely tannins. And I was watching that every day. And then I'd already sourced the spirit. And then when you do a little calculation, you work out the fortification point, and you have to be precise about that. That could be at 8 a.m, that could be 3 a.m, that could be midnight.
Yes.
So you have to be Johnny on the spot when you make fortifieds. Anyway, so fortify the port, and then it went to tank. Now, there are three different batches here, and they're all co-fermented varieties. I just find that the wines are a bit more harmonious when they're co-fermented. You get a lot more of flavour interactions when you do that, as opposed to single varietal fortifications. So there was three batches. We'll call it the head, the aromatic component, the heads. It's not the spirit heads. Was the Portuguese wine, beautiful, elegant, and aromatics. And then the core, the guts of it, was the Shiraz Alicante co-ferment. And then I made the Jerif component a little bit sweeter as well, just because it just gave a little bit of a kick at the back. Anyway, it came to blending, worked out the required percentages, and blended it all, and then bottled it later in the year. So it's it sounds a lot simpler than what it actually is, but there's a lot of fun that goes into it.
Yes, and and of course you're now spreading the word and. Any particular restaurants about that you're talking to about if people want to try where they can go and if they're eating out they can try this, because it's good to talk about it, but you really need to let people know where they can get their hands on it.
True.
Apart from contacting you, Celador or online, where would they see it in a restaurant, say in Melbourne?
At the moment, no one has taken it on as of yet. But soon, there is a new restaurant in South Melbourne called Lume. And they're looking at doing quite an impressive dessert with it.
Oh, right.
It's on Coventry Street.
Yep.
I have seen the concept. I've spoken to them about it, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Yep.
It's quite an impressive dish and quite an impressive experience.
Lume. So that's a new a restaurant that's opened or coming?
Coming.
If Lume.
Everyone's read about it, heard about it.
Oh, have they?
It's, there's a lot of anticipation with
it. And when's that opening?
I think in 2 weeks.
Oh, 2 weeks, right. So you can go suggest if you people want to try it, go along there and sample it for this surprise sweet. But there's more to it than just sweets. It'd be nice to see people putting it on in other parts of the a tasting menu, wouldn't it?
It matches well with, especially in winter now, I find it does match well with some main meals.
But anything in particular? What are you matching it with?
Ragouts.
Yes.
Kangaroo, even.
Kangaroo? And they hop to it. People, sorry, I couldn't resist that. The kangaroo. I'm a real bounder, sorry.
I've even had it with goat before.
With goat?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, goat's very nice, isn't it? People seem to sort of, oh, goat's tough. It's not tough at all.
Goat's
beautiful. Lovely. Mm. Beautiful.
And then you've also got your cheeses, which are fantastic. And
particular sort of cheeses, though, aren't they?
Rockford's always a favourite.
Oh, yes.
Good Stilton that will grow legs and jump out of the fridge is also
Yes. Or even a Bavarian Blue you could have with it.
Exactly. Yeah. But I also love like the beautiful gooey cheeses, like the Daffnoises. The Triple Breeze. Like they're fantastic.
Yes.
They just match it perfectly. But I also, one of my favourite cheeses is Pecorino.
Pecorino. Has that got as much flavour as you'd want it sometimes with Pecorinos?
Oh, they
vary a bit, don't
they? They do. But I just love it when you get a good Pecorino and you've got the big chunks of salt all through it.
Yes,
just so Moorish.
Yes.
But I do find that works quite well with it as well.
That's a great thing about wine and food pairing now. It's got out of its straitjacket of the old days when it was, you know, you went to a function and the girls were served chicken and the blokes were served a steak and that was it, and you had your red and your port. And the whole concept now of wine and food has just opened up so much, and people are doing fun, adventurous things with it. Like PX, you know, served at the beginning of a meal with a sort of foie gras sort of dish, like exactly. It's made to be done, not just relegated to after dinner or served with a pudding.
Interesting you say that, because that's one thing I talk about regularly is enjoying fortifieds, not just vinos, as aperitifs.
Yes, why not? Exactly. Well, we drink sherry as a dry... Well, some people are old enough to remember drinking a fine sherry as an aperitif. Nothing, or even, I've served in winter, sparkling red as an opening gambit in winter. Yeah, chill the behind of it, and it's something a bit different. And it's good to be different and try things out, because that's the whole thing about wine and food, isn't it? You're continually experimenting. And what's to say that, you know, the new matches are any less valid than the old ones?
Let's talk about experimenting. A wine that I've made is a white port as well.
Now, explain what a white port is to people who may not know.
When people think of port, they generally think of red port. Okay? Yep. And so simplest thing with that is it's made out of red grapes, whereas a white port is made out of white grapes.
Which grape in particular?
Depends where you go. Yes. If you go to Portugal, it's made out of that Arinto that you were speaking of earlier on.
Yep.
Gouveio, Donzelino Blanco.
Yep. We don't see much of it in Australia, though, do we?
No, there's not. There's only probably two producers that I think of, and they're reasonably sweet, whereas good traditional Portuguese-style white port is dry.
Yes.
And when I say dry, I mean drier than most ports, in a tawny port or a vintage port, and quite refreshing. And the way they consume it over in Porto is actually as a long drink. They either have it neat or they have it in a long drink with glass, with tonic water and mint. And it's fantastic.
Sort of, really?
I drank a lot of it when I was over there as a winemaker, and I loved that concept. And I thought, why don't we drink it like that here in Australia? Are we purists that we don't want to see us mixing wine with a soft drink?
Yeah.
We don't want to see them being used as a soft drink.
Yes.
So I thought, well, try and embrace that concept here. I've tried it with muskets. I've tried it with topakes.
Yeah.
And I think it does work. It's just getting people to outside their comfort zone and trying it.
Yes. True. Well, the whole dining scene is changing. We'll be eating meals made of printed 3D printers one day. And of course, people, I jokingly said to a food critic, I think it was Stephen Downs one day, Stephen, I'll do the wine matching if you start talking about a meal of insects. You know, and I never heard from Stephen, but I think he thought I was pulling his leg. But I actually wasn't, because a goodly part of the world's population eat insects daily. So, you know, things are changing. Now, I remember I alluded to, and you ought to speak to this guy, Wayne Farquhar in the Barossa. He's just started a winery called Deluva, D-E-L-L-U-V-A. And he thinks Arantino's going to have a home there. And I think Jancis Robinson calls that the Portuguese Riesling, that grape variety. He thinks that's got a home. He also thinks Tariga will become increasingly popular. And is it Mencia, is it?
Yeah, Menthia.
Menthia, yep. And Alvarino have promising futures. But he's planted a lot of, spent years and years with some Italian professor researching clones. And he's passionate about, in the same way of, his Italian varieties in the way you are that you're Portuguese. So it'd be interesting to perhaps speak to him one day. Now, where do you see the northeastern Rutherglen heading in the future? Because I was up there recently and penned an article about that and tried to do my take on it. Where do you see the future of the northeastern? Because there's a lot going on. I mean, there's the excitement from what I call the dress circle at Beechworth. Not many cellar doors, but some magnificent wines and younger winemakers doing fantastic things with varieties. The Alpine Valleys, and then you've got Rutherglen. And of course, you've got the King Valley. But what do you see as the future and what's happening up there?
I think there'll be a lot of people taking another look in the northeast soon. As you say, the Dress Circle at Beechworth, that's a lot of interest created by some core producers who have been there for nearly three decades and really upholding the reputation of the place.
Yep.
But there is a fantastic younger brigade making wines at the moment, and I feel very much a part of that, and we're all friends and we're all helping each other out.
Now, who else is put some names to who else is?
So in Rutherglen, you've got Rolly Milnich at Sign. He's doing fantastic things with Giriff and Viognier.
Yes.
You go to Beechworth, you've got Pete Graham at Domenica.
Yes.
XG Conda.
And Rodder.
You've got Adrian Rodder. And then you've got Rodder. Tessa Brown and Jeremy Schmaltzer at Vineyard Schmaltzer Brown. They've just planted a vineyard at Stanley.
I think Max Allen wrote an article about Beechworth recently in The Australian. And he put his thumb on it pretty succinctly, as Max does.
He did. It was a good article.
Mm.
Someone else he didn't mention was Chris Catlow. So Chris, I made wine with. He's got Sentio Wines, and he does fantastic Chardonnays and Shiraz. And then you go up the valleys, you've got Glenn Epperback, and he does a few bits and pieces in King and Alpine Valleys through his label Prima Donna.
Mm-hmm.
Jo Marsh at Billy Button.
Jo Marsh.
She's doing fantastic things.
And Eleanor Anderson at Mayford.
I use that Tempranillo as a benchmark for my wines. That's beautiful.
A lot of people do.
Mm.
And, of course, that's Mark Scalzo, of course, his project at
Piano.
Opposite on the other side of the hill from Gioconda.
Mm.
So it's pretty exciting.
Mm.
And I think I get the feeling that Rutherglen has energised the people in, Beechworth has rubbed off on Rutherglen and vice versa, I think. And we're all the better off for it. Simon, I'm going to have you back one day because we've barely scraped the surface, but we're out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for, arigato?
Obrigado.
Obrigado, thank you. I knew it sounded more like Japanese the way I pronounce it, but anyway, at least I made the effort. Thank you for your time today. A pleasure talking to you, and I hope you'll return and update us with your progress.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Well, that's about it. My research material was sourced from my home library, winebiz.com, The Age, The Australian Grape Grower and Winemaker. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on all stations around Australia via the Community Radio Network. And it's cheers from me, Michael Hintz. And please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.